Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels' family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy B. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
And today we are concluding our two-part episode on the renowned poet Edna St. Vincent Millay. She was the first woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. She was one of the Guggenheim Foundation's judges for its poetry fellowships. And she was also wildly best-selling. She managed to sell tens of thousands of copies of her poetry and make huge amounts of money off of it in the middle of the Great Depression, which seems like a hard thing to do. Her work was so popular that every new book that she published sent her on a reading tour around the country. And in 1940, she was also elected to the American Academy of Arts and Letters. In 1931, artist Georgia O'Keeffe wrote a letter to Edna St. Vincent Millay. And in this letter, she told a story about a hummingbird that got trapped in her studio. So she caught the hummingbird, but every time she opened her hand just a little bit to try to get a look at the hummingbird, it would break its way free and then go bash itself against the window pane. She described it as being just so full of life that it couldn't be contained, no matter how she tried. It took her 4 tries before she was actually able to get the bird outside, because every time it would break out of her grasp and then just go hurl itself against the windows. Georgia told Vincent that she was like the hummingbird, and that if Vincent didn't get what she was saying with this description, then surely her husband would. I think that characterizes her character pretty well. And the first half of our episode today really, or the previous one, the one from earlier this week, looked at her early life chronologically. For her later life, we're instead going to sort of organize it thematically. Going chronologically would be a little kind of a slog. So we're instead going to kind of talk our way through some common themes in her life after she got married to her husband, whose name was Eugene Boissevin.
Yeah, so we left off right after they had been married. And for a while after their honeymoon, Vincent and Eugene rented a house in Greenwich Village. But eventually, Vincent wanted to be somewhere quieter where she could still be to host friends, but could also really focus on her writing.
In March of 1925, they found a 700-acre farm for sale in New York, and they bought it for $9,000. Vincent named it Steepletop, and that was named after a kind of flower that grew there. This was a steeple bush, also known as hardhack. It has these pink kind of pointy flowers. The property was in really poor condition, so Vincent and Eugene put a huge amount of time and work into actually making it into a functioning farm.
And it had an outdoor bar where, in their words, the flowers were watered with gin. Freestanding doors led to what Vincent called her garden rooms. And they later put in a spring-fed swimming pool where bathing suits were not allowed. It was only skinny dipping. And they also bought and built a barn from a kit that they purchased from Sears. They raised animals in addition to the food crops that they raised there.
They built a riding cabin for Vincent, and this was set back among some pine trees. When it burned down to everything but the stove, they built another one. Vincent spaced out the windows so that she could see who was in the pool without easily being seen herself, because the pine trees would block the view for most of the places people could stand in the swimming pool. So she would look out the windows to see who was down at the pool and at the bar, and then she would decide whether she wanted to come down for happy hour or stay in the cabin riding.
That sounds sort of like a glorious life, doesn't it? Like,
it really does. The whole time we were there, because this whole episode comes after a visit to Steepletop, and the whole time we were there, I was like, you know, if this were simultaneously walkable to stuff like stores and places to get groceries, this would be great. But it's a little isolated.
And apart from some time that they spent traveling, Steepletop was really Vincent and Eugene's home for the rest of their lives.
While Vincent did do a lot of work in the garden, she had almost nothing to do with most of the household duties that would have been more typical and expected of a wife at the time. Eugene's whole goal in their relationship was to make sure Vincent had whatever she needed to write. So the house was fully staffed. Vincent said that she liked to walk into her dining room as though it were a hotel.
Well, that's stark contrast to when she was a child and basically took care of her entire home for her mother and sisters.
Absolutely.
And Steepletop was also a home to their friends, some of whom came to stay for weeks at a time. Arthur Fickey and Gladys Brown eventually bought property nearby, and they named their property Hardhack.
At first, Eugene's money was what paid for their life at Steepletop. But Vincent's writing eventually started to bring in an income of her own. Poetry made her really rich. As someone who majored in poetry in college, this is bizarre to me.
This is a super unique situation.
Yeah. Well, and you know, poetry did used to be a whole lot more popular in America and in other parts of the world than it is right now, but maybe not to the point that people would really be rich. But seriously, poetry made her very rich, but they also spent their money very freely. So they didn't always have a lot of cash on hand. Some years, Steepletop actually turned a profit, and other years it was more like a tax write-off to kind of buffer this income that was coming in from her royalties.
And just to kind of, you know, make a clear picture of how much money she was making as a writer, it was a lot. They actually were able to buy an island of their own off the coast of Maine at the height of the Great Depression. Of course, it was not a terribly expensive island. It was $750.
But that was still $750 extra dollars to buy an island with during the Great Depression.
Yeah, that's a lot at that time, for sure.
Yeah. So, if we left Vincent and Eugene's story here, their life at Steepletop would sort of sound like a happy, semi-bohemian extension of what their life had been like in Greenwich Village. So settled and happier, but still really full of drinking, and a series of lovers for both of them. But as Vincent got older, her life got a little more difficult and a little more nuanced.
Vincent's life and work had really made her a role model for women. She lived a life of personal autonomy and sexual freedom, which were completely unique at the time. And this is one of the reasons why her poetry was so incredibly successful. Women flocked to it and its themes of love, sexual liberation, and living life your own way.
So all of these themes made a lot of her work implicitly feminist, but very little of what she wrote in her early career was overtly political. On occasion, she did call out the hypocrisy of being referred to as a woman poet instead of just a poet, or of being, for example, honored at a university only to then be sent off to a social that was, quote, for the wives instead of being allowed to, you know, hang out with the other honorees. But for the most part, she just lived as she wanted to live, and then other people were inspired by doing that. She was sort of being an activist by example, rather than being an outwardly demonstrative activist for most of her life.
And two notable exceptions to this came a little later in her life. The first was the Sacco and Vanzetti case. There's actually a previous episode in the archive that Katie and Sarah did about them. But Sacco and Vanzetti were Italian anarchists who had been accused of murder, and they were tried and sentenced to die in 1921.
There were layers and layers of unfairness and injustice about the trial, and the sentence was one that divided Americans. Intellectuals, artists, writers, and others flocked to support the two men, and the effort to get their sentence overturned went on for years.
Vincent was on the side of clemency. In 1927, toward the end of the battle for the two men's freedom, she and Eugen went to Boston to march and protest, and she wrote a poem entitled Justice Denied in Massachusetts.
While they were in Boston, Eugen bailed out demonstrators who had previously been arrested. Vincent also marched herself and was, along with other protesters who were marching with her, arrested herself.
And when Vincent was freed, she was granted an audience with the governor, and she took advantage of it to plead for the men to be spared. In the end, though, they were hanged, and Vincent's own trial became news, with the media calling her an American Joan of Arc. And she was eventually acquitted.
Vincent's writing took another political turn during World War II. Earlier in her career, themes of pacifism had been woven into some of her work, but as cities in Europe started to fall to Hitler, her views really shifted. This was especially true as German troops invaded the Netherlands, which put Eugen, her husband's own family, at risk.
Vincent was speaking and writing in favor of going to war long before the United States did, and during World War II, some of this work was definitely propaganda. A lot of it resonated with the public, but reviews from literary circles were pretty scathing. Her literary reputation didn't entirely recover from this period during her lifetime.
Before we moved on to one of the most notable and also kind of ill-fated love affairs during her later life, let's take a brief moment and talk about a word from a sponsor.
Stupendous.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper, waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
So to get back to Vincent and Eugen, we're not describing their relationship as polyamorous, since that's not a term that was coined until the late 20th century, long after both of them had died. But their marriage was definitely not monogamous on either side. Their relationship was meant to be unpossessive and welcoming of other people. And for Vincent in particular, the excitement and passion of a new relationship often seemed to make her poetry a lot better. It really inspired what she was writing about. And as we've said before, Eugen really wanted Vincent to have whatever she needed so that she could write more poetry.
And guests at Steepletop, it will probably be no surprise, included Vincent's past lovers, both male and female. Eugen would make himself scarce when he felt like, you know, it was time for him to step out.
One of Vincent's most notable relationships during her marriage to Eugen was with the poet George Dillon. Like Vincent, George was a gifted poet. He won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry. He also won 2 Guggenheim Fellowships. He was the editor for Poetry Magazine, which is a very prominent and established poetry journal. The two of them also worked together to translate Baudelaire's Flowers of Evil into English.
George and Vincent met after a poetry reading that she gave in 1928, and at the time, he was only 21 and Vincent was 36, and Eugen at this point was 48. The relationship inspired Vincent's sonnet sequence called Fatal Interview. Some of their letters also survive, and they tell the story of a passionate, ecstatic, and erotic love affair. It bordered on obsession, with Vincent trying to figure out any way she could for them to see one another.
It was also a relationship that really threatened to undo Vincent and Eugen's marriage at a couple of points. It led to one of the longer separations of their lives, when Vincent and Eugen both went to Europe, but Eugen went back home alone so that Vincent could be alone with George.
Vincent wrote to Eugen while she was away, and her letters seemed to try to reassure him that he was loved and that she missed him. But he wrote her far more than she wrote to him. And it seemed as though she loved Eugen, but she was in love with George.
This sort of disparity started to weigh on Eugen, and he became increasingly worried that his wife was never coming back home. When she finally did tell him that she was ready to come home again, he was elated and he went to Europe to meet her rather than waiting for her in New York.
Vincent's relationship with George did continue off and on for years, and it eventually became a very tumultuous one.
Yeah, and it did ultimately end, and her sonnet sequence, Fatal Interview, kind of chronicles the rise and fall of this kind of extremely passionate but also kind of rocky relationship. Vincent also seemed almost beset by tragedies later on in her life.
Her friend and colleague, Eleanor Wiley, died in 1928, and Vincent received word about it just as she was about to take the stage for a reading at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Instead of reading her own work, Vincent recited Eleanor's from memory.
Vincent's mother, Cora, got sick in 1931 and died that February. After Vincent had received word that she wasn't doing well, but before she could get home to see her. They brought her body home to Steepletop, and it had to be brought by sleigh over the last leg of the journey because the snow was too deep. Cora's casket lay in the withdrawing room surrounded by flowers for 4 days while they literally blasted a grave into the frozen granite on the property at Steepletop. Vincent and her sisters all felt tremendously guilty over their mother's death. Although her acute illness seemed pretty sudden, she had been complaining of being vaguely unwell for a couple of years, and they all felt like they should have done more to help her and possibly prevent her death. They wound up sort of saluting Eugene's mother at the same time when they had a graveside service for Vincent's mother, because his mother had also died the week before.
Vincent actually reconnected with her father when he reached out to her in 1935. He was, in fact, writing to ask her for money. Vincent actually sent the money, and she ended up providing for him until he died years later.
The next year, Vincent and Eugene were in Sanibel Island, Florida. They checked into the hotel, and they went directly to the beach to look for seashells. Vincent really loved seashells, and there's still a huge collection of them surviving in the dining room at Steepletop. While they were out, the hotel burned to the ground, taking with it everything that they had brought with them. This included a personal copy of a 17th century book, the manuscript for Vincent's next book, and the manuscript for another book that she had been working on. It took her more than a year to try to reconstruct all of this writing from memory.
Oh, that's hard to think about. Vincent's younger sister, Kathleen, died of acute alcoholism in 1943, and she was also, by the end of her life, experiencing some degree of mental illness.
At this point, a huge rift had developed between Kathleen and Vincent. Kathleen was also a poet, and she just could not get out from under Vincent's shadow. She had also started to feel like her sister had stolen all of her best ideas and made them famous in her own work. She became kind of obsessed with the idea that that her sister had done her wrong in some way. She'd also been asking Eugene and Vincent for money really often before her death, and Eugene often felt like she was asking for money and then squandering it. So she would ask for money for medical bills, but then spend it on something else, and then need more money for the medical bills as well as more money for something else. So they were really kind of estranged by the time she died.
In 1945, Arthur Fickey, Vincent's longtime friend and occasional lover, died of throat cancer, and he was buried on his property at Hardhack that was nearby to Steepletop.
On top of all of these personal losses and tragedies, Vincent herself really started to struggle with alcoholism and drug addiction later on in her life.
She really wasn't in good health for much of her adult life. She had ongoing problems with both her digestive and her reproductive systems. She experienced frequent headaches. And according to one story, during the 1920s, she was talking to a psychologist at a cocktail party about them. And he was a Freudian and began to ask questions that suggested that he thought she might be a lesbian. And she said, "Oh, you mean I'm a homosexual? Of course I am, and heterosexual too, but what's that got to do with my headache?"
I love that story.
I do too.
In the later part of 1928, The King's Henchman, which was an opera for which Vincent had written the libretto, was being performed in New York. A winter storm hit Steepletop, and she didn't want to miss the show, so Eugene decided to take her to the train station in a sled. He misjudged a gap in the hedge along the way, and a branch hit Vincent in the eye and scratched her cornea.
As you can imagine, that is immensely painful, and medical care for such an injury at the time was focused on killing the pain rather than treating the injury. And she wound up having trouble with her sight, unable to read or write for weeks, and even after the eye had healed, that injury really made her chronic headache problem even worse.
She had another accident in 1936. She was leaning against the car door while Eugene was driving, and he went around a sharp curve, which caused the door to fly open. She fell from the car and rolled downhill for a while before she managed to grab some vegetation and stop herself. This was another injury that prevented her from riding at all while it healed.
By the late 1930s, Eugene was describing Vincent as too sick to leave her bed a lot of the time.
She really blamed the pain from the accident for starting her addiction to morphine and other painkillers. Although, that doesn't quite add up, because in the intervening years, there aren't many references to that pain in her letters, her diaries, and her medical records. But regardless, she was eventually taking enormous, enormous doses of morphine. She was also combining it with alcohol and other drugs. She was taking far more morphine than Arthur Fickey was in his last days as a cancer patient, for example. You know, usually when someone at this point was in the end stages of cancer and being treated with morphine, they didn't really pay a lot of attention to the dosages. In some ways, this is still true today. She was taking like multiple times more than his dosage was for end stage cancer pain. She would also take her first dose of morphine within minutes of getting up in the morning.
Eugen tried to get her to wean herself off of these drugs, even taking morphine himself and reducing his own dosages to see what she was going through and as proof that it could be done. Vincent wound up in inpatient treatment for her addictions multiple times. She also had a nervous breakdown in 1944. And at one point, she and Eugen retired to Ragged Island so she could try to work her way through recovery there.
That was the island that they had purchased during the Great Depression. In addition to this drug addiction, Vincent was also an alcoholic, eventually to the point of having alcohol-induced blackouts on a pretty regular basis.
And even as she slowly reduced her morphine intake, largely by replacing it with other drugs, she continued to drink and drink heavily until the end of her life.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper, waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
In 1949, Eugen was diagnosed with lung cancer. An x-ray had actually revealed a spot on one of his lungs a long while before that, but he had ignored it. Everybody sort of assumed that it was tuberculosis, and he really insisted that the more important thing was for him to take care of Vincent.
He made it through surgery to remove the diseased lung, but he ended up dying of a cerebral hemorrhage on August 29th.
In the aftermath of Eugen's death, Vincent had to be hospitalized, and she finally convinced her friends and family that she absolutely had to return to Steepletop. The only way she was going to make it through was to write her way through her grief while she was there. So she had the phone reconnected so people could check on her, and then she went back to Steepletop to live alone.
On October 19th of 1950, John Pinney, who worked on the property, was bringing firewood when he saw Vincent on the floor at the foot of the steps. It is not entirely clear what happened. There was a bottle of wine and a wine glass on the stairs, and she had clearly broken her neck when she fell. According to her obituary in the New York Times, it was a heart attack. Vincent was 58, and Eugen had been dead for a little over a year.
Her ashes are interred next to Eugen's at the end of a trail that's now known as the Poetry Trail at Steepletop. Cora's gravesite is there also, as well as Norma's, that was Vincent's sister, and Charles, who was Norma's husband. They are all sort of collected together as five gravesites at the end of this trail.
After Vincent's death, her sister Norma moved into Steepletop with her husband, the artist Charles Ellis. Norma kept her sister's things as untouched as possible. She kept her own cosmetics and personal items in a shoebox so they would never get mixed with her sister's. And Norma chose to hang her clothes on the shower curtain rod in the bathroom. It is a very large bathroom. There was a lot of space there, but still, she would not use the closet because she seemed to intuit that her sister's home was going to be important and that she should preserve everything in it as it was.
Based on Vincent's income as a poet versus her expenses, it seems as though she would have been in a position to leave kind of an endowment to keep the place running after her death. After all, she'd been seeing huge sales of poetry in the middle of the Great Depression. She was making between $17,000 and $21,000 a year during the late 30s. There's not really a great way to put that into today's dollars, but it was easily the same as having an income in the hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
And she was also writing more commercial work at that time under the pseudonym of Nancy Boyd, so she was getting income from that as well.
So even with medical bills, paying for medical care for Vincent's father and sister, and their generally free-spending lifestyle, it seems as though they should have been pretty financially stable. In reality, though, Vincent would ask for a generous advance from her publisher for her next book, and that would let her pay off the debts she had incurred since publishing the previous book. So she was always sort of living off of loans from her publisher for work that she hadn't done yet.
Biographer Daniel Mark Epstein's hypothesis, which is supported by letters and some other documents, but it is not conclusively proven, is that before the Great Depression, Vincent invested most of her money in a thoroughbred farm and continued to do so well into the 1930s.
She was definitely known to love horses and horse racing, but this paper trail is kind of scanty and convoluted. And it's also possible that she really wanted to keep the thoroughbred farm, which was being used, of course, to raise racehorses, a secret because her father's gambling, which we mentioned in the previous episode, had been so detrimental to her family.
And then the war also intervened. So some of Eugen's money was actually back in Holland, and all of his assets there wound up being frozen, so it wasn't like they had access to any of that.
So today, Steepletop is still standing in Austerlitz, New York. It's run by the Edna St. Vincent Millay Society, and it's open for tours from the end of May to the end of October. Because they were not really financially flush at the time of Vincent's death, the society is raising money to restore some of the rooms that aren't currently open for public viewing. There, you are able to see parts of the home if you tour it, but not everything, because there are rooms that still really need some work. They also have a new head gardener who's working from journals to reconstruct the property's landscaping and gardens. And it's pretty much all donation supported. There's not really a fund from the author's estate that's keeping things going at this point. But if you are interested in going there, it's pretty awesome. It's 2.5 hours from New York City and 2.5 hours from Boston. So you can get to it pretty easily from a couple of places.
I'd say it's probably safe to say it is on Tracy's recommended visiting list.
Oh, yeah. It was lovely. We toured the house and we toured the gardens, and then we walked on the Poetry Trail, which is the trail that goes out to the grave sites. And it has little plaques along the way that have poems about what you're seeing there in the landscape and in the vegetation that's growing there. So it's really lovely. We also went pretty much the first weekend of their season, and so there was nobody there but me and Patrick and a couple of docents.
Nice.
Yeah, it was a very lovely trip.
Do you also have a spot of listener mail for us?
I do. This is actually a very lengthy letter, so I am only going to read about the first half of it. It is from Stephanie, and Stephanie wrote to us after our Deaf President Now episode. And she wrote to us, and she starts off with some talk about how she has heard the name of Gallaudet University pronounced, which we've gotten a couple of notes about that, and we now have collected, I think, 4 different pronunciations for people, how people say the name of it.
So you have options.
Yeah. So she says, there is an interesting story that we were told about Gallaudet going to Europe to learn sign language. And that was the elder Gallaudet who went to try to find out how, some information about the best ways to teach deaf people. He went to several places that were either based on the oral tradition or private academies that would only teach him sign language for a price. So he was about to leave without accomplishing his goal when he met someone from a deaf institution in France who invited him to come to their school and learn French sign language free of charge. He met a deaf French scholar, Laurent Clerc, who came back with him to help set up deaf education in America. To this day, there are many signs that are based on French concepts in American sign language. Yet British Sign Language is very different from the American. I heard you say that the differences between those of the oral tradition and the culturally deaf are not as much of an issue now as cochlear implants. I agree with you that it is not as much of a national issue as before, but I do not think I can agree that it is no longer an issue in the deaf community. I'm going to pause there and clarify what I was trying to say, which is that the thing that is not so much of an issue is whether to teach children who are born unable to hear now sign language. Like, there's not really an ongoing debate about that. The much bigger debate is whether a child who is born now not able to hear should have a cochlear implant or not.
Right.
To get back to the letter, I was an interpreter for the deaf for several years, and though it has been about 10 years since I interpreted, I do not think things have changed that drastically since I was in touch with the deaf community. I had learned sign language as a child, as I had a personal friend that was deaf. He had about 35% hearing in one ear and almost none in the other, yet he was sent away to a boarding school for the deaf in Missouri and learned sign language. And so even though he could hear a little, he communicated through American Sign Language and not the PSE or pigeon-signed English that oral deaf students used. Bernie was able to interpret for his friends, though, since he could tell better when someone was speaking and he could read lips very well. Even though he was so adept in the hearing world, his communication was truly in the syntax of ASL and not English, which is another reason that closed captioning does not help many of the culturally deaf, since they do not think in English syntax. Therefore, the words that they are seeing don't make sense because they're not in the right order, and many of them don't read English very well. I've worked in the public school system and the college system interpreting for the deaf. And one of the main classes the culturally deaf must attend is ESOL, or English for Speakers of Other Languages. I remember having many conversations with deaf friends, coworkers, and clients who expressed passionate opinions on each side of the deaf culture issue. There were those who absolutely did not want to look strange, and so wanted to keep the sign language interpretation very low-key. And those who did not want to see anything but the lecture signed and nothing extra, like jokes or comments from the hearing students. The two factions were very much at odds with each other. Like I said, it has been 10 years, but I really think there is a very definite divide, even now, between those two communities. And then I'm going to conclude with a story that she shares before the letter goes on. And she says, one time I was interpreting for a personal friend who was deaf and also a coworker. She was a guest at a women's club, and the object was to educate the ladies about deaf culture. One of the questions she was asked was, how do you handle your disability? I think the lady wanted the deaf friend to explain if she felt living in a hearing world was difficult or if she thought she handled it well. I am not handicapped, she shot back when I signed the question to her. You are handicapped, she signed. I can communicate with you, but you cannot communicate with me. And that is where I'm going to end the letter. partly because that's only about half of the letter. She had all kinds of awesome, awesome information in it. But that's similar to a story that I. King Jordan told in the address that he gave at my alma mater that I saw, where he was talking about when people who can hear come to Gallaudet to visit, and they go to the restaurant on campus at the school. Like, a hearing person is definitely the person who's in a position of having a handicap, because the cook is deaf and the servers are all deaf. And when he was there, he was not sure if they still did it. But when he was there, the way that they dealt with this was that they would leave pads of notepaper on the tables for the hearing people. So it was, he was definitely talking about how disability is contextual. And there are definitely circumstances where a person that could be described as, quote, having a disability is absolutely not disabled in any way. So, yeah, I really appreciated having that story from Stephanie. If you would like to write to us, you can. We're at historypodcast@howstuffworks.com. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/MissedInHistory and on Twitter at MissedInHistory. Our Tumblr is missedinhistory.tumblr.com, and we are on Pinterest at pinterest.com/MissedInHistory. If you would like to learn more about something that came up in the episode today, you can come to How Stuff Works and you can put the word addiction into the search bar. You will find the article How Addiction Works. You can do all of that and a whole lot more at our website, which is howstuffworks.com. You can listen to archives of every episode and see our show notes and all kinds of other stuff at missedinhistory.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency, where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway the great American race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR, the Motor Racing Network. Work.